And the other thing we have to do is create new bidding procedures for the drug industry because they're getting away with murder. Pharma has a lot of lobbies, a lot of lobbyists, and a lot of power.
We're going to spend $2.4 trillion in healthcare over the next 10 years. 85% of it's going to be spent on something other than prescription medicine.
I'm Dan Diamond, this is Pulse Check, and those were two of the most influential voices in the drug pricing debate. The first, somewhat obviously, was President Donald Trump speaking several weeks ago about the drug price problem as he sees it. But the second voice is Stephen Ubel, the head of pharma and the industry's top lobbyist. We caught up last week, right after his trip to the White House, and after a year of intense scrutiny on drug prices, and with multiple controversies for the industry. On this podcast, Ubel shares his perspective on the drug cost debate, the new administration, and the reforms he'd like to see. Then at the end of the episode, you'll also hear from Sarah Carlin Smith, our pharma reporter at Politico, on how she's covering the industry and what she makes of Ubel's remarks. But first, some housekeeping as usual. Please remember to review and rate Pulse Check on your favorite podcast app. We have nearly 100 ratings on iTunes. We'd love to make it to that round number and help us figure out who we should be focusing on in the year ahead. You can always reach me at ddiamond@politico.com if you have suggestions for who we should be talking to and what topics we should tackle. And now, here's Stephen Ubel. I've heard you described as America's top healthcare lobbyist. You've been successful at multiple advocacy organizations. You're always on script. You're soft-spoken when others are over the top. Do you think you're America's top healthcare lobbyist?
Oh, gosh. I'm from Minnesota. I don't know if you're familiar with Minnesotans, but they have a very hard time acknowledging that they're the best at anything. I could tell you that the Ole and Lena story about the
Ole and Lena jokes, actually. Yeah, there's a whole series of them.
There is, about the guy who loved his wife so much, the Minnesotan, who actually broke down and told her. That I think just speaks to the, humility. Being from the Midwest is a proxy for a lot of good things, but you're never going to get me to say I'm the best at anything.
So, yeah, there's a lot that Minnesotans keep inside. Apparently you do, too. Let me then frame the question a little more broadly. We've had Chip Kahn from the Federation of American Hospitals, your former boss, on this podcast. Great lobbyist.
He actually wasn't my former boss.
Oh, he
just,
wasn't.
When I was at the Federation, I worked for Tom Scully.
Right.
And I left, actually, to join AdvaMed before Chip arrived.
So no overlap directly.
No overlap.
But he's a great lobbyist.
Absolutely.
You are a great lobbyist. There are several others we've had on this program. What qualities do you think a top lobbyist needs to have?
Yeah. The best advice I ever received, and I've been blessed to have really good mentors. I would include Tom, of course, in that, but also Pam Bailey and others in my career. And the best advice I've ever received is to dive into the substance, to really truly understand the issues that are being discussed and debated and be able to engage on a policy level. So I take great pride in really studying the issues that impact our sector and try to engage on a policy basis.
One of those engagements was just this week. You were at the White House. President Trump summoned pharma. On the scheduling, it even said Trump meets with pharma. It was very generic. Can you tell our listeners how that meeting came together? Who reached out to whom?
Sure. We requested the meeting. It was really a terrific discussion, very positive and constructive. We focused in really three areas. He's laser focused on jobs, of course. So we talked about our economic footprint today. The industry employs 4.5 million Americans, directly or indirectly. We invest $70 billion in R&D, which is more than any other U.S. industry. But we think we can do more. And we discussed with the president things like lowering corporate taxes, reducing the regulatory burden, whether that's at the FDA or other elements of the government. We talked about additional steps at the FDA. For example, I've talked a lot about steps that could be taken to make the generic approval process more efficient. if you look at some of the major press stories over the last year in our industry, the common denominator of Turing, Valiant, and Mylan is they're all old drugs. They're off-patent medicines where there's really regulatory arbitrage. There's lack of effective competition, and we think there are targeted solutions to issues like that.
And just to double back on that, the common thread that I've heard pharma point out is those old drugs, the price has been hiked because it was able to. Different problem than some of the other drug pricing issues that have been in the news.
Yes. Again, I think they're all fact-specific, but the common denominator is that they're old, off-patent medicines where there's a lack of effective competition. So you want to create a system where an entrepreneur or a company can eat Martin Shkreli's lunch, but it's hard to do that if it takes 4 or 5 years to get a competing generic on the market. And these are oftentimes complex issues. For example, a generic manufacturer might have manufacturing issues. You know, and leaning on my medical technology experience, in the medical technology sector, there's a lot of small and mid-sized companies. And the FDA really needs to get into a posture of engaging those companies that might have manufacturing or other issues to try to encourage generic entry.
You just mentioned Martin Shkreli. I was kind of expecting, like Voldemort, we're sitting in your pharma office, that we would not even mention his name. He is the hoodie with no actual name that we would call, but you volunteered him. Your new campaign, You've talked about it. It's hoodies, not... No, sorry.
Less hoodie, more lab coat.
That's right. It's this very cinematic ad campaign. Mm. Go boldly, I think, is the tagline.
Rage, rage against the dying of the light. Do not go gentle into that good night.
What is the investment that pharma has put in to this marketing campaign? Can you put a dollar figure around
it? It's high tens of millions of dollars over a multi-year period. So it's a very ambitious effort. It really has three pillars. The first pillar is really about getting people excited about the science. Again, we're leading into a new era in medicine. I've taken about 60 trips since I've taken this job, really touring the labs, talking to researchers and scientists, and I'm struck in those interactions that I can't tell you how many times they've pulled me aside to say that they're disappointed that the actions of a few have really diminished their life's work. You know, these individuals look nothing or sound nothing like some of the individuals that have been marched before Congress and so forth. And we really, some of the things I've seen in the labs, harnessing the body's immune system to fight cancer or CAR T, taking cells out of the human body, reprogramming them, sending them back in the body on smart bomb missions. I mean, this is stuff that would be referred to as science fiction just a few years ago. So we want to ensure that real scientists and real patients who benefit from those advances are highlighted. So that's one key pillar. The second key pillar, and actually I think is more important than the ads that we're running, is what we call the Value Collaborative. We're going to be holding events at the state and local level around the country focused on how do we evolve the pricing model for medicines, a new and better way of paying for medicine. And this has been underreported, in my view. We do need to move away from a volume-based system to a value-based system. Our companies want to put their money where their mouth is, engage directly with payers, and are willing to be reimbursed differentially based on the outcome achieved by the patient. It's a much more granular negotiation than takes place today. You know, the typical negotiation today with a PBM is based on rebates and discounts. We think the system needs to evolve away from rebates and discounts towards these outcomes-based models. And we're going to be convening stakeholders in the payer community, the hospital community, and the physician community to talk about the barriers that stand in the way of more of those arrangements taking shape.
So that's a fairly nuanced message. When you met with Trump this week, it was on the heels of his comment that the pharma industry is, quote, getting away with murder. Sitting down with him, explaining this message to him, do you feel like the White House gets that approach? Did he say things back to your industry that you feel like are putting the White House on the same plane with pharma, or is there still a gap between what you think the industry needs to do and what Trump thinks the industry needs to do?
Yeah, I don't think I want to characterize the specifics of the conversation. I've mentioned that he was laser focused on jobs, and we talked about
again, reducing taxes, the regulatory burden, and other steps. But also, he's very focused on innovation. I think he, you know, keenly understands what's at stake, that we lead the world in the development of better treatments and cures, and that we have to sustain the ecosystem so that we remain in that leadership position. You know, the other issue we discussed is trade. You know, I think the president is very focused on better trade deals that protect our investments in R&D, our intellectual property, and ensuring that we protect not only the intellectual property, but the, you know, American jobs that flow from that. So we think there was significant common ground in all those areas, and we look forward to working with the administration going forward.
Well, one way that America leads the world is because our drugs go through an intense regulatory process. Mm-hmm. Trump has talked about, or at least his team has hinted, that they may go a different direction with the FDA, mm-hmm. gut regulations. A Peter Thiel associate, Jim O'Neill, who's talked about just speeding drugs to market, could be an approach if he was named FDA commissioner. Where do you want to see the FDA go under Donald Trump?
Well, I would push back a little bit on the characterization that they want to gut the FDA. But our view is, you know, the FDA review process is the gold standard around the world, and we want it to remain so. There's a lot of terrific people at the agency. But there are steps that can be taken that make the process more efficient. You know, I've talked about the generic approval process, for example, which I think there are targeted reforms that could enhance the review of generic products, enhance competition, and therefore address some of the outlier cases that have been so prominently featured. We also think if you look at 21st Century Cures or the user fee agreement that we recently concluded with the agency, there are really key provisions within both of those agreements that will, the legislation and the user fee agreement, that we think will again encourage better patient access to the new treatments and cures that are coming. So things like better use of real world evidence or modernizing the clinical trial enterprise and other steps the FDA could take that again would encourage patient access, enhance competition, and therefore reduce costs. So if you look at the hepatitis C breakthrough, for example, a lot of attention around the launch of Sovaldi, but several other companies are now in that space. Prices have fallen, by published reports suggest, around 60%.
Though the prices are still very high.
And, you know, the value is also quite high. If you look at the reductions in hospitalization, the reductions in the incidence of liver cancer, I could argue that medicine priced where it was at launch or priced where it is today is an incredible bargain for the broader healthcare system and society as a whole. You know, there's this whole dimension of value that never gets captured, which is people returning to work and paying taxes, the reductions in burden on caregivers. So we're eradicating a wretched disease that has all these dimensions of costs that often aren't contemplated.
And I do think it's fair what you're getting to now, Steve. There's a huge debate over companies like Turing or like EpiPen and raising the prices there. Mm-hmm. Very different debate over breakthrough drugs that are curing people.
Absolutely.
And that's where the Sovaldi issue falls. We've danced around it a little, though. Mm-hmm. Drug pricing is an enormous issue in the industry mm-hmm. right now. Mm-hmm. Drug prices have gone up dramatically in various ways, and not just by Turing and EpiPen. There were 375 drugs covered through Part D that saw double-digit price increases. I think it was 2014, mm-hmm. and many that saw
list price increases.
So some impact on the consumer at minimum. I think the average out-of-pocket spending on prescription drugs is up about 25% since mm-hmm. 2010, 2011. What is your industry doing? Mm-hmm. What are you telling Donald Trump to control drug pricing in a more sustainable way?
Well, first, I think we have to get general agreement on the facts. You know, Senator Moynihan had this great line, you know, that everybody's entitled to their own opinion, but not their own facts.
Yeah, well, it's a new era in D.C. There do seem to be facts and alternative facts, but I agree with you. We should have ground rule facts around the drug pricing conversation.
So let's make sure that you and I are
I'm
in
looking
agreement.
Right into your eyes. Go ahead. Tell me your facts, and I will tell you if I agree.
Okay. So what's happened over the last few years, so if you were to go back 3 or 4 years ago, you would find that, that drug spending was quite low and, in fact, would have been a leading-edge contributor to restraining overall cost growth. We then went through a spike in drug spending that was relatively anomalous. It was driven by the introduction of the hepatitis C cure. It was a year in which 45 new medicines were approved by the FDA, a record number of approvals. Medicaid was expanded. A fewer than expected number of drugs experienced patent expiry. All those factors led to a spike in spending. We're now on the back end of that, where drug spending
is moderating.
Growth is decelerating. And if you asked
But it still wildly outpaces inflation.
Everything in healthcare outpaces inflation. But if you ask the CMS actuaries where drug spending is going to be in the next 5-10 years, it's between 4-6%, which is exactly the rate of growth of every other item and service in healthcare, physician spending, hospital spending, and so forth. So we have to, you know, if we don't define, you know, the facts on the front end, we could be subject to setting policy that's tied to the spike and not the long-term arc of prescription drug spending. We're going to spend $2.4 trillion in healthcare over the next 10 years. 85% of it's going to be spent on something other than prescription medicine.
Right. 15% on prescription medicine. So it definitely is a minority of all of the healthcare spending categories.
A minority. It's a fraction.
Yeah.
And I would argue that that 15% is arguably the most important 15% that we're going to spend, especially with the exciting new advances that are coming our way. If we can turn more and more cancers into manageable chronic diseases like we have for HIV, AIDS, and other conditions, we have to step back and acknowledge that chronic disease and people with multiple chronic disease drive an overwhelming share of healthcare spending. And these interventions are our best and perhaps only opportunity to ameliorate those costs long term.
So one of the arguments against pharma is that no one disputes the value of seeking cures, but that there's a lot of money that goes into marketing of pharma products, direct-to-consumer marketing. Even the new ad campaign that came out from pharma looks gorgeous, doesn't really mention drug pricing. It focuses a lot on R&D. Can you speak a little bit to whether pharma is putting enough toward R&D and putting too much maybe toward marketing?
Yeah, as I said at the outset, our companies are spending $70 billion a year in the United States on research and development, which is more than any other industry. With regard to DTC, the point I would make is that there is a value in stimulating conversations between patients and physicians. You know, you think about the stigma attached to mental health, for example, and we have a mental health crisis of sorts in the country today. Having those direct-to-consumer advertisements that can lead to inform conversations between patients and their doctors, I think, is a good thing.
Well, we just agreed on one fact. 15% of all spending on prescription drugs, you said that was a fraction. If I look at the spending by major companies, Merck, J&J, J&J spent 13% of its revenue on R&D. Merck spent 17%. Pfizer spent 16%. By your own definition, that 15% of something is a very small number. Shouldn't they be spending more on R&D?
Well, I think you'd have to look at individual companies, but most companies are spending a lot more in R&D than they are in marketing. And they're only launching typically one or two new drugs a year. I think the innovation process, the complexity, especially today, you know, we're sort of at the top of the mountain where it's steepest and hardest to climb. And we're going to see medicines that are wholly different than the medicines that were developed in the past. Really, as we unravel the benefits of knowledge around the human genome, and we are better equipped to personalize medicines to individuals in a truly personalized way, I think you'll see more research and development investments given the complexity of the science.
There are a number of different healthcare industry groups jockeying right now over what the future of health reform will look like. Where does pharma want to see health reform go, especially with possible ACA repeal on the table?
Yeah, I think our North Star, you know, the prism with which we'll look at any reform policy is, does it continue to support patient access to breakthrough treatments and cures? I think we see the contours of how reform is going to unfold. And we're going to see plans be given more flexibility in benefit design. States are going to have more flexibility in terms of shaping their own insurance markets, as well as having more autonomy with regard to Medicaid, for example. And again, the prism with which we'll view that is through ensuring that whatever policy evolution takes place in that direction, that patients still have access to the medicines they need.
There seems to be a lot of jockeying between the different industry groups. Everyone looks at the other one to blame. The Federation of American Hospitals, your former employer, had come out with a report not so long ago where they said that drug pricing was out of control. These price increases, this is a quote, these price increases are wreaking havoc throughout the healthcare system. Is your former employer wrong?
I think it's unfortunate that we have a bit of a circular firing squad that has developed in the private sector, across sectors within healthcare. There's a lot of complexity in our healthcare system, and I think it bears directly on the drug pricing debate that we're having. I think we have to recognize that insurers ultimately set the terms of what a patient pays out of pocket. We just released a study that showed that 40% of the list price is rebated to actors in the supply chain, whether it's insurers or PBMs or government mandated discounts, wholesalers and distributors, pharmacies. It's complicated. Hospitals. Hospitals on average mark up the cost of a drug by 600%. So rather than pointing fingers, I think we need to work together in a collaborative way to ensure that the private sector can lead in terms of the discussion around healthcare reform going forward.
Do you see, this is something I've tried to report on, do you see one leader who can kind of stand between all the different industries and make peace and bring them together, or are we not in a space where that can happen right now?
I think it's challenging right now, just given the number of issues that every segment is wrestling with. Clearly insurers have concerns around stabilizing the market. You know, we share those concerns, but they're going to be heavily engaged in how that develops over time. But I have made a big point of reaching out. You know, I went to speak to the AMA Board of Directors at the gracious invitation of Jim Madeira at the AMA. I've reciprocated and invited him to address our board. I think our industry needs to do a better job of reaching out to all stakeholders in the system, which, back to our discussion of our campaign, you know, the key pillar of our effort is really going to be to convene stakeholders and have a candid discussion about how we can sustain this new era of medicine and also evolve the pricing model.
I want to close on a question or two about the politics around healthcare right now. 2016, a hard year for the industry. Major candidates attacking drug pricing. Trump also ran on this slogan of draining the swamp in Washington and taking on Washington lobbyists. I felt like for you, probably had to feel a bit like a human pinata, given the conflagration there. Yeah. Who do you think on the Hill right now gets your issues best? Who is the lawmaker who best understands what pharma is and what your values are?
I think there's a lot of members who are comfortable with the complexities of healthcare and understand what's at stake in ensuring that we continue to lead the world in innovation. You know, naming names is always challenging, but, you know,
I'm guessing it's not Bernie Sanders or Elijah Cummings.
Well, I mean, Chairman Greg Walden was involved in our meeting at the White House, and I continue to be impressed with his background and knowledge. Tom Price, who's been nominated as secretary, I think brings terrific experience to that role. You know, the Speaker, Senator Hatch, and others, I think, have been outspoken about the valuable role that you know, private sector negotiation plays already within Medicare. You know, Part D is one of those rare government programs that has come 40% under budget. It features, you know, private plans negotiating with our manufacturers, producing on average 35% discounts with record high beneficiary satisfaction. So I think there are a number of members that are very engaged in our issues.
Last question. You raised membership fees about 50% last year. My understanding is that pharma is now taking in about $300 million per year in your coffers. Where where is that money going, especially with a price hike for your members? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do with that added war chest?
Well, the public affairs campaign, the Go Boldly campaign, is a major component of that. As I mentioned, high tens of millions. It's a multi-year commitment. But also, just across the board, my vision for pharma is a more engaged association and an association that is going to do a better job of developing third way ideas and some of the proactive policies that I've talked about, you know, whether it's making the generic approval process more efficient and solving specific problems that have gotten so much attention, or eliminating the barriers to moving towards innovative contracting, you know, giving consumers the type of information they need. You know, unfortunately, we have this transparency discussion in Washington, but also in the states, that seems to suggest that, well, we're going to measure all the discrete inputs regarding a specific product, and then we're going to pay you on some derived basis. If that's X, it's going to be X plus Y. You know, our view is that's a predicate for a price control. And it misses myriad aspects of the discovery process, not the least of which is the cost of failure. So, you know, one of our major member companies invested, you know, tens of millions of dollars, collectively billions, within the industry in Alzheimer's, and we have nothing to show for it, sadly. And the costs of failure are not reflected in that type of analysis. Instead, we think we should have a transparency discussion that's focused on information that patients actually want and need. You know, is my doctor covered by my plan? Is my hospital in the network? You know, is the drug I need covered by my plan? Is it on a formulary that I can access? Those are the types of information that consumers really want. So we do think that there are policy solutions, pragmatic consumer-oriented policy solutions that can address healthcare costs holistically, and in some cases address some of the issues that have been appropriately raised about our sector.
It's a hard job. It's a hard messaging job and a political dance. Thank you for making time to walk us through the contours of your world.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to Pulse Check. We'll be right back with Sarah Carlin Smith, but let's take a quick break to hear about some of Politico's other podcasts.
I'm Isaac DeVere, host of Off Message Season 2, an interview series focused on who our political players are and what drives them. Look for us every Monday morning.
And I'm Scott Bland, host of The Nerdcast, a Politico reporter roundtable that discusses the data and the facts behind the political punditry every Friday.
You know when's a great time to listen to political podcasts, Scott? During your commute.
Yeah, like say if your commute's been backed up by a presidential motorcade, or...
Or maybe there are just hundreds of thousands of people in the street protesting.
So if you've had a good commute or a bad commute, or even if you work from home, subscribe to Politico's Nerdcast and Politico's Off Message today on iTunes or your favorite podcast app.
And now, Sarah Carlin Smith, our pharma reporter at Politico, and we reached her while she was running around the Capitol building doing some reporting. So, Sarah, you heard our conversation. You cover this beat every day. What did Yubel get right and wrong?
So, I think, you know, the pharma talks a lot about how their companies are not Martin Shkreli or Valiant. They don't take old drugs and buy them and jack up the price. And yes, he's correct in that sense. And most of the members of pharma do R&D, they develop new drugs, but the consumer outrage and even some of the political outrage around the costs of medicines has not just been centered on Martin Shkreli and Valiant. There are broader issues going on in the field that do hit many of the companies he represents. And that ranges from everything from there's been a lot of talk about the price of diabetes medicines and insulin, which are old drugs produced by many of the pharma companies. And when I say pharma, I mean the pharma lobby he represents, that have risen in price exponentially over the years, despite there being competition and many players in the field. There's many drugs, new biologic medicines, hepatitis C drugs, cancer treatments that patients aren't just upset about rising prices. They just can't afford the base price that they come on the market with. Sometimes they're double, triple digits on a yearly or even monthly basis. So there are broader pricing concerns where it does hinge on kind of the mainstream brand name research and development drug companies besides just the Martin Shkreli's in terms of the world. And I think that, I mean, to be fair, pharma would like to deflect it a bit more on tiering and volume, but they can't completely as much as they want to separate themselves from the cost conversation, as he would like to do.
How much is actually hitting consumers in their pocketbooks? This is something that has been broadly debated, the idea of rebates and list price being not the price that consumers are actually paying. What has your reporting shown you?
Sure. And I think one of the frustrations among consumers here is it's very hard to know what price they're going to have to pay because it varies based on their drug plan, based on are they in a high deductible plan that doesn't cover drugs? Are they in a government program where some of the coupons drug companies try and give out to make drug pricing a little more affordable can't be used? One of the things I've seen said reported by a number of people is that usually while list price isn't what, you know, your health insurance company or your pharmacy benefits manager is paying for the drug, sometimes a patient's copay or coinsurance is based on the list price. So if you're responsible for 20% of a high-cost drug, even if your health insurance company never paid $20,000 for that product, your copay might be based off of that $20,000. And in Medicare Part D, one of the problems there, which is the big government-run prescription drug benefit program for seniors, is the list price also triggers when seniors hit this catastrophic threshold level, which if you hit that catastrophic threshold level of drug spending, the government ends up being on the hook for most of your costs. And so what Medicare has noticed over the past couple of years is more and more patients are hitting this catastrophic level where taxpayers are then on the hook for 80% of the cost of these high-cost drugs. And that, whether you hit that threshold or not, comes from the list price. So yes, it is fair to say that a patient with insurance, their insurance plan probably is not paying the list price for most drugs, but the list price is affecting the whole health system and how much drugs are costing the system and sometimes individual patients.
One of the biggest battles in this space across the past year was around Medicare Part B. I didn't have time to discuss it with Yubel, but we've talked about it a lot on this podcast. There was an entire episode last year where a proponent of Medicare's proposed demonstration to change how the program paid for Part B drugs faced off against a critic of the program. Ultimately, that demo was defeated last year. It was seen as a big victory for pharma. With no Part B demonstration moving forward, Sarah, is there anything out there to rein in pressure on Medicare Part B drug spending?
Medicare Part B is a tricky issue because unlike in Medicare Part D, where the drug industry is bright, that there are private health plans that negotiate with drug companies to try and get down the list price. Medicare Part B reimburses doctors for prescribing these often very high-cost physician-administered drugs at the average sales price plus a certain percentage add-on to that. So that means there's really nobody in the system that has any real ability to check the prices set by drug companies. And this is something that MedPAC is still looking at and suggesting changes for, even though the Part B demo failed. And these are some of the most high-cost drugs in the system. And right now there is, again, there aren't those kind of checks on it that on the drug pricing that pharma can very fairly say exists for Part D drugs and your outpatient drugs, the things you pick up at CVS. So this is a very different playing field where the government doesn't right now have a lot of ability to get those prices down lower.
So last question, and this was kind of where the conversation with Yubel went near the end, value-based purchasing, or the idea, to put it really bluntly, that drug makers wouldn't get paid as much or maybe at all if drugs weren't working. That seems like a good, just concept. It parallels other value-based purchasing efforts around healthcare. You reported on this extensively in Pharma. Is this really going to be a way to control drug spending?
I think for certain drugs in for very specific disease states, this may be one tool in the toolbox, but this is not a silver bullet. And people who follow this area have said this is a popular idea. It emerges every few years. Some drug company and some payer take a drug and they do a pilot, and then nothing ever comes of it. And the reason why is because it is very hard to say for certain diseases and certain drugs, did the drug fail the patient? Was it the drug's fault that the patient, you know, didn't get better from the cancer? Did the drug do everything it could have done? Did the patient take the drug appropriately? Is it the patient's fault? Is it the drug's fault? And it ends up being too costly to administer and kind of assign blame or, you know, credit to the drug. And then you get, you know, lots of cases where people are also saying, you know, value-based or, you know, kind of rewarding companies for when their product works is great. But again, nobody's necessarily saying we have lots of bad drugs out there. Nobody's saying Gilead's hepatitis C drug hasn't cured a lot of patients of a very devastating disease and that it's not worth a decent amount of money. But the problem is, even if it does cure everybody, that's great. We still can't afford to pay, you know, $80,000 or $40,000 for every patient in Medicaid, you know, or every patient in the U.S. that needs it. So to a certain extent, it distracts from what some people would say is just the prices are too high, even if the product is working and it's valuable.
Real last question, and then I'll let you go off and chase senators or whatever you're doing today. Yes,
sure.
Yes or no, will there be a drug price reform bill this year, 2017?
I think there will definitely be drug pricing reform measures that pass Congress this year. I think the question now in my mind is how broad it is and how much impact it really has. So last week, the Energy and Commerce Committee indicated it's going to take up a bill that kind of aims to attack the Martin Shkreli's of the world, but it doesn't quite do much that FDA isn't already empowered to do. And so I think there's a question of whether of how hard Congress may actually go on this issue and how far they'll go. So I think they'll definitely do something to at least say they've taken some action on drug pricing, but I think we'll have to see whether they really kind of do meaningful reform that really changes the whole system of how pricing is kind of set or controlled here in the U.S.
That's it for Pulse Check today. Thank you to our producers, Bridget Mulcahy, Matt Sobosinski. Thanks to Sarah Carlin Smith for dialing in from the Capitol. You can find Pulse Check on all of your favorite apps. Please remember to rate and review us, especially on iTunes. And we'll be back again with a new episode for you next week.